are things that we could make life better if we just use cars less. Like, it's not about taking cars away from people. It's just about giving people more options. It reduces greenhouse gas emissions. Sure, that's what I was obsessed about. But it also makes it easier to get to jobs for people that are trying to move up in the world. It's better for public health, right? Like, it reduces air pollution. You know, there's a million reasons. Like, it's good for the prosperity of the economy, right? Like, every dollar that you put in the gas tank, it goes to, you know, to a different province or a different country. So anyway, there's a million reasons why transit is good for the world. And yet, at a policy level, it's so hard to make progress on transit. So I think that's where that passion comes from, is just seeing how beneficial it can be and seeing kind of a void, you know, that there's just not that, there hasn't really been much advocacy for it yet in this region.
That's so true. And just don't tell me, did you come with all of that up during your undergrad, or is it something that was building up?
It was building up. I remember distinctly being a huge Green Party supporter when I was a teenager. Like, I was a hugely nerdy and political teenager in a place that, like, I was from rural Eastern Ontario where there was just nothing. There was not a lot of outlets for my nerdiness. There was also no public transit. Like, I didn't know what urban planning was until I got to university. And so I did my first 2 years at a university that was kind of very environmental. It's University of Guelph in Ontario. And it was there that I started to learn about urban planning and cities, what it's like to live in a city, what it's like to have transit at your doorstep. Like, that's kind of, Guelph gets a lot of the credit for who I am today, but they don't have an urban planning program in undergraduate. So I had to leave Guelph to actually do my dream. But anyway, Guelph gets a lot of the credit.
Oh my God. Oh, I relate to you so much. But I think you forgot a really important mention on why transit is important.
Oh yeah.
Meeting people.
Oh yeah?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel that even though here in Canada a little bit less, but everywhere I've been, I've met so many people commuting. Mm. And this is actually the premise of this show.
I love it.
My idea is that I want to start bringing the microphone to the bus and having people share a little bit of their backgrounds, interests, and stuff like that on the bus.
I love that.
Yeah. So, meeting people. We should talk more on the bus.
Yeah.
Take out your headphones, or at least half of it.
Well, that's right. And it has real repercussions. Like, you know, it's been proven that the politics shift in places where everyone drives. Like, places where everyone is in their car going from place to place, they end up with less empathy for others. They just have less reason to interact. It changes your whole outlook. So you're totally right about that.
Yes. So, moving on. You've been involved with a few projects. One of them, and that's where I came to meet you, so that's why I'm asking this here, the Participatory Budgeting Initiative. Mm-hmm. For those who don't know, it's basically a project that was pilot in Brazil during the 90s. And they invited citizens from every district of the city to discuss how the allocation of 20% of the city's budget would be, and put that together. No parliaments, no council, no lobbying, just basically people coming and voting and discussing what is missing in their neighborhoods. And they kind of tried to do that here in Vancouver. And I heard your name from there. So yep. I want to know, what do you know from Vancouver's attempt to start the participatory budgeting here? Which was your initiative? Can you tell me more about it, please?
Sure. Well, I was just one of those people, those citizens that showed up and pitched a project. But basically what happened was that Vancouver really needed to increase the parking fee in the West End because it was too congested. They proposed participatory budgeting as a way to spend the money that they were going to earn from this parking fee. So it was a way, I think, of making it a bit more popular to raise this parking fee and say, oh no, don't worry, we're returning all of this money we're raising to your community, to the West End. And so they did this process, but it wasn't 20% of the city's budget. You know what I mean? Like, it was on a totally different scale. It was just a few hundred thousand dollars. And I was really fed up with a particular street in that neighborhood, Denman Street, which just fails for every mode. It failed for walking, it failed for cycling, it failed for driving, and it failed for transit. It's the slowest street for transit in the region. And it was terrible for cycling, even though there were 10 bike shops or something on Denman Street. And the sidewalks were so narrow for people walking. And I got together with a local urban planning firm, Happy Cities, to try and get people to imagine, hey, let's imagine changes to Denman Street that might make it not suck for everyone. But we lost. We lost the project. But it was fun. It was fun to be a part of it.
Yes. So that's where we begin our role of advocating for more participatory budgeting. Let's put out more attempts to increase local participation rates in the assemblies and general interest in the governments.
Yeah.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about your passion. Mm-hmm. I'm so interested in it. I know you can spend hours here talking about transit, right? So what I could start with that I was curious about is about about the Deer Lake environmental group. So I have here a question about it. So I know you've worked with groups like them, and there are some tools like density maps to inform transit and housing decisions. Why do you think it's so important to like bring community voice into transit planning? How do you ensure their feedback is like reliable and on policy? I don't know, tell me about your relationship with them. I would love to hear more about it.
Well, okay, specifically with Deer Lake Environmental Group, it's the Deer Lake United Church that they're really interested in climate. And there was a process last year where the City of Burnaby and Van City and SFU got together, and they brought in a bunch of people from Burnaby to do local, small local climate-related projects. They were thinking, excuse me, let's go really small scale, really local, and see what we can do in our own community to reduce GHG emissions. And Deer Lake was one of the groups that participated in that. I was brought in to speak at one of the events to talk about how transit plays a role in that. And they reached out to me later on, and they brought me into their church to talk about, you know, what movement is doing. And so they're really great. But on the whole, the question of how these connections with other groups is part of the process, it always comes down to power. It comes down to, are elected officials intimidated by your group, right? Like if they see a group like Movement and they think, well, they don't control any votes, they're not going to be relevant for my reelection, they're not going to change whether I get reelected or not, then they don't have to think about you. They might want to think about you. Just like participatory budgeting, it's where the government is going out and actively wanting to hear what the people think. But generally, politics ends up being about power, like who has to think about you. And so the idea behind Movement is that we need transit riders to represent this big, powerful group that politicians can't ignore. And when you build relationships with other groups, like groups that nobody expects you to get related to, so like churches, like cultural groups, like first responders, like ambulance, firefighters, you know, like they use bus lanes, right? Like if the bus lane isn't there, then they can't get through traffic. You know, there's all these different groups that we can build relationships with that ultimately grows the power of transit riders to the point where politicians can't ignore you.
Beautiful words. I'm inspired.
Excellent.
Oh my God, it's so good to have you here. I want to move from the piece of activism and not to necessarily the general problems of like Vancouver. I believe I saw some things you speak about that, those problems everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, some mentions would be great to have from you, of course. Mm-hmm. What I'm looking to try to understand here is like, if you feel comfortable sharing a little bit of your role, which was at TransLink,
sure,
moving to Movements and then the actual work you get done, just this like as you were mentioning, this lobbying for the government. So like how this work is done, mm-hmm, what are some cool projects you've done there to change the problems in Vancouver? Mm-hmm. So like basically, yeah, transition, TransLink, Movement, and then the problems themselves.
Sure. it was my dream to work at TransLink, like when I was a student in Ontario, and we all kind of looked up to it as urban planners. And I never thought I'd get to work there, but I got a job there as a student in the very bottom. Like I was, you know, going to farmers markets and events and telling people, hey, ride the bus, you know, try a bike, you know, just kind of promotion, and gradually work my way up. And the most of my career there was focused on making buses better. So like when the Evergreen extension was built to the Millennium Line, I worked on the project to move the bus routes to connect with the SkyTrain better, the new SkyTrain line. I also worked on launching the Rapid Bus brand, so the 5 Rapid Buses that were launched in 2020. I worked on that. And then the last thing I did at TransLink, I was on this new team called Bus Speed and Reliability, where we were focused on being really strategic and tactical and finding ways to speed buses up, to put it in either bus lanes or all these other tools. There's bus bulbs and queue jumps and all these buzzwords that I could throw at you. But it's, at the end of the day, the focus of the team was, let's make buses faster and more reliable. And we had a budget of $8 million that we were giving out to the cities who own the streets, because ultimately it's their street. We can't force them to put in a bus lane. They have to decide to do it. But we can pay the cost of doing it. And that's what this project was about. So $8 million, the year that I quit, we only gave away $3.5 million. Less than half of the budget was given away. And the reason was that city staff didn't feel they could put in bus lanes. They were afraid of it, right? Like that their leaders in the city government were concerned that if they tried to put in a bus lane, they would get complaints from either local businesses or residents or whomever would say, oh, we need this parking, we can't get rid of the parking, or, oh, we need this lane of traffic, we can't have it replaced to a bus lane. But these were in places where the buses were moving way more people. Like, you think about a few dozen parking spaces versus a bus that's got, you know, 30,000 people on it. The logical urban planner kind of mind is like, well, of course this makes sense. What's wrong? What's going on? And I could see that the problem wasn't anything within kind of the logic or the, like, if I just make a good argument, if I just find the right data, no, that was not going to change anything. These things weren't happening because they were getting a lot of opposition from, you know, a few loud voices in the public and no support. There was no one out there saying, I actually want a faster bus. I actually need this because I'm constantly late for work. I can't afford a car. So as a result, it's like impacting my life in the following ways. So it became so clear to me that what was needed was a group outside of TransLink, outside of the cities, that was raising the profile, like raising the opinion, like what bus riders want, their voices, and bringing those voices to elected officials. And the example I sometimes go to, which is a little bit controversial, is the NRA in the US, the National Rifle Association. They were just a gun club 100 years ago, a bunch of people like showing each other how to use guns. But they made the choice to become powerful, right? Like over time, they focused on influencing government, influencing politicians, to the point where every single election in the US, the National Rifle Association plays a role. And either, you know, if you don't like guns and, you know, the National Rifle Association says, hey, this candidate's really bad, you can put that on your signs. You can say, hey, the National Rifle Association hates me. And that's great. And if you do like guns, you want the opposite. You want to put on your signs, I was endorsed by the NRA. Like that's power, right? And that's what transit riders need in order to change the situation in Canada.
And I have just one quick question about it, and it's maybe for more of personal interest. So referring, what is the difference for you, and how do you see it, like the difference between internal activism, like the power that TransLink would have for lobbying, and the power that you have outside of TransLink? What are your restrictions that inside of TransLink? What do you have now that you can do outside? Like, what is your action?
Oh, yeah. If you're a TransLink employee, you're really limited in what you can do in terms of activism, right? Like there are obviously rules around it. They're not very restrictive. But at the end of the day, if you're an urban planner, if you're a professional and you want your career to grow and you want to have a good relationship with people so down the line you can work on a project with them, you have to be careful about what you say. It's not like a, you're not allowed to do this. It's more of just like a, this could limit your ability to get that next job that you want. So you have to be careful. Whereas, now that I'm outside of TransLink, I can kind of just say whatever I want, which is nice.
I would imagine.
Yeah. And how no money does... in it though.
For now.
Fingers crossed.
It's going to become a national movement.
I love that. I think you're right, Tiago.
I'm curious just on this side, like, so how, what is exactly the type of work that you do inside of movements? Like, how do you do the work?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. On the point of money, we just were talking about money, more and more of it has become fundraising because we... Like, I look at, there's groups like Movement all across the United States. There's dozens of groups. And there's groups like in Minnesota, the group has a budget of $1.2 million a year. And we are nowhere near that. So I want this to be sustainable for the long term. And that means having paid staff, enough money to have permanent paid staff, multiple people, you know, for a long time. And fundraising is the biggest gap in that. So honestly, my number one job right now is fundraising. If anyone is listening to this has $50,000 to spare, you know, that's the kind of money that we need. So like from corporations, from unions, from educational institutions of higher learning, like ones that might be named after Simon Fraser, we need money. Anyway, what else do I do? Also just organizing campaigns, right? Like, finding ways to get the attention of people in power. And sometimes it's senior leadership at the cities, like the head engineer or the city manager, but most of the time it's elected officials, city councilors, mayors, MLAs, MPs. And so, you know, there'll be issues that come up, like on Hastings, there was a big fight around bus lanes. And so you... put out emails saying people like, hey, you know, join this effort, you know, come volunteer and canvas with us and talk to riders and, you know, make videos and make phone calls. And it's so at the end of the day, what is the work? It's just a lot of communicating, getting people that finding the people that are angry about a certain issue and giving them a way to express that anger that actually is the most effective thing they can do to make that change.
Sorry, I need the silence. I've told you my passion about this, so I'm just admiring your words. thank you.
You're welcome.
Specifically, I have like two questions that I want to tackle, just maybe on the outside, not need to go so, unless you're interested and you want to discuss them. One is like, what do you think are the biggest issues for Vancouver?
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, what are the big issues in terms of like marginalized group access to the specifically the transit? So
sure. Okay. So the biggest issues in Vancouver when it comes to transit is just that there isn't enough of it and that there's no road space dedicated to it. So the first one meaning we don't have enough buses on the road. There are buses all across this region that are jam-packed with people and that are constantly leaving people behind because they're full, right? Like, you'd think, oh, well, in a data-driven world, like, that means we'll just put more buses on. But TransLink hasn't really had more buses to put on the road since basically 2019. And so what they've been doing since that time is just moving buses from places that are a little bit crowded to places that are desperately crowded. And just kind of trying to keep things afloat with the buses that we have. But we just need way more buses. And the second point that I made is that we need lanes for those buses to go on. We need to allocate road space to those buses because we know that when you change a lane from a car lane to a bus lane, the capacity of that lane goes up by four times. It's like a quadruples the capacity because buses are so much more efficient at moving people. And so when you think about congestion in this region and how congestion is growing, it's getting harder and harder to get around. we could fix that by widening roads and widening highways, but we know that some cities have tried that and it doesn't turn out great. And Houston is the example of that, or, you know, Toronto, Los Angeles. So the only other way, if we're worried about congestion, is to somehow use the roads we have more efficiently to move more people. And bus lanes are really that, the tool. Like SkyTrains and Metro and whatever is something we should start planning for now and be building into the future. But we know that that takes decades. And we can do bus lanes tomorrow. You also asked about what are the key issues for
marginalized groups,
people access. With lower incomes. I think they're getting pushed out of the neighborhoods that have the best transit access, right? Like, you know, transit is the cheapest way to get around unless you're lucky enough to be able to walk or bike to where you're going. But those are also the most expensive neighborhoods, the neighborhoods that have good transit, because they're more desirable, because you get to save the whole expense of having a car. And so we need more neighborhoods that have good transit access, which means improving transit, right? And it's been interesting to see that where, like, you might think, oh, well, if affordability is an issue in the region, people with lower incomes are going to just move to the most affordable housing. But the most affordable housing is deep in Langley, Abbotsford, Chilliwack, where transit is almost non-existent. They're not moving out there because they would have to own a car, and that would end up costing them more overall. So the places with the highest increases in transit usage are actually the places that are kind of in the middle. They're not on the SkyTrain, and they're not way out in the farm fields. They're in places like Newton and Sunset in South Vancouver, where they have kind of good transit access. Like, they don't have SkyTrain, but they have buses that are kind of frequent. And those are the buses that have had unbelievable growth since COVID. Like, there's a street in Surrey, 128th, which barely, no one really thought about or talked about, you know, 10 years ago in terms of transit. Like, the bus route was not that busy. It was pretty plain. These days, it comes every 6 minutes with an articulated bus, the buses that are double length, because of how many... I think it's because that's kind of a place that people can afford that has, like, decent transit. So we need more affordable housing next to transit and more transit next to affordable housing. We need to do both.
I have just one question out of this that you just said. Do you, and it's personal opinion, do you think it's easier to... I know one is dependent on the other, okay? Mm-hmm. Just choose one. Sure. Do you think it's easier to fix housing? So, like, access to housing in Vancouver, and that those were be connected to transit? Or do you think it's easier to expand transit?
I think it's easier to expand transit. Like, you can buy a secondhand bus from, like, some other city tomorrow, and then you can paint a bus lane. Also do that tomorrow. You know what I mean? And get those on the road relatively quickly. It literally just takes time to build a house, right? And then we have this crazy, like, regulatory process that adds so much time to the cost of to building a house, that one is definitely slower. And there's also a lot more opposition to building affordable housing. Like, there's so many people that are opposed to the idea of affordable housing that you'd have to overcome. I think we should do that. I think we should fight that fight. But we should also fight the transit fight.
Okay. I expected that answer, but I like the way you phrased it. I have basically two more questions for you. One of them is kind of a funny one. I think we're in a bit of that. Like, I was wondering, like, if you had, like, magical power, I don't know, Aladdin lamp or anything that you could change in Vancouver first. Like, right now you can change in Vancouver, like, yeah, magic power. Well, why would you transform in Vancouver? Like, what do you think it would be the best?
God. I mean, I guess, I don't know, do I have to... What I'm going to say is just so obvious, right? Like, I would immediately build, like, 10-story buildings for, like, the entire extent of the city of Vancouver. It would just be 10-story apartment buildings. We would have so much housing that landlords would have to beg you to move in. And, like, half of that housing would be publicly owned by the government, like not by some housing agency, like owned by the province. And they would price it based on how much income you have. That would be my dream. And it's had nothing to do with transit. It's mm-hmm. just that it's so clear in this region that we just need like twice the number of homes.
And Vancouver is such a magnificent city. Like, yeah. Oh my God, there's the city is, it's so perfect. If you look, it's full of natural beauty. It's access to water, access to energy. It's like,
it's a great place to live. Like, in, you know, our climate future, like, it is an excellent place to live for so many people, for so many reasons, that we could have a sustainable lifestyle that has a small footprint on the environment. It's just that we make these choices to have unbelievable poverty in this city. It's such a choice that we don't, you know, just, if I'm Aladdin, if I can just snap my fingers and have a magic wish, I'm going to do that. I'm going to get more housing.
You're so right about that. That would ease so many problems.
Totally.
Yeah, imagine the movie city with affordable housing. That's the dream.
Yeah. Auckland, New Zealand is doing it. Tokyo, Japan, they're doing it. Let's get in line. Let's do it ourselves.
While we don't have that, let me move to the next question.
Sounds good.
Let you leave without this question. You know that, right? Uh-oh. You know what I'm talking about?
I have no idea.
Oh, come on. We're in Burnaby Mountain right now.
Okay.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
That's true.
There's one thing that every student here wants. There's the gondola.
Build that gondola. Build it.
How do you feel about the gondola? Do you think it's coming? Do you actually think, like, they promised 2027. I mean, they have the full video. Like, mm-hmm. you've seen the sea from the top. Yeah. It's going to be so beautiful. Do you think it's actually coming out? Do you have any takes on that?
It's inevitable. I think that it's so silly. The whole bus situation right now is so silly, right? Like, I mean, it was a pretty outrageous idea to put a university campus on the top of a mountain. But the result of that choice is that we have to run these diesel buses up and down the hill every day, hundreds and thousands of times. You know, the buses that go up to SFU, they catch fire. The engines catch fire on a higher basis than any other bus in the region because it's carrying 120 students up a steep slope. It's like straining and straining. And I keep hearing these stories of engines catching fire. So anyway, the system that we have today to move students to campus doesn't work. Gondolas are the solution. I think I know that there are people on TransLink working on it. I understand that the costs of transit projects keep going up in Canada, and that's a problem we need to get a hold of. I hope that it can be delivered in like a cost-effective way. But in any case, yeah, it's a logical project. It's going to change everything for people on campus. And you couple it with the fact that the Millennium Line will be going eventually all the way to UBC, and it's just going to be so much easier to get to campus.
Oh my God, imagine Burnaby Mountain kids actually being able to take a class in UBC, having integrated campus. Yeah, that exists. I mean, just no one wants to commute 2 hours.
No, exactly. It's such a long distance. I mean, as it is, the students having to commute to the Surrey campus, so it takes a really long time.
Yeah, 50 minutes to 1 hour, going down in Columbia.
Yeah.
It's not easy. It's not, especially if you have an 8:30 class. That's my case.
Oh my gosh! It's I'm sorry.
during the winter, it's cold. It's dark outside, and oh yeah. Anyway, it's okay. It's gonna be okay.
It is.
Well, final takes and final stabs in here. Is there any message you wanna pass on that we can put? You can like broadcast to everyone. Ooh. Like, maybe police officials, like maybe just for students or anyone you want. Give me a message.
If there's something that you think is impossible, like, oh, it's never going to happen, like we can't do this, I guarantee you there's an example where someone did. It's already happened somewhere, somehow. And that you can, you know, you're in university, you can read about it, you can do the research and figure out how things change. Because things do change, they will change.
The best way to engage during university is to actually be interested in something and research it outside of class. Oh well, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Actually a productive talk.
Yeah.
I'm just so passionate about movements right now. And I think that was it.
Thanks, Tiago.
Thank you, Dennis. And thank you everyone who followed up live this segment. Hope you enjoyed. And following up is The Sprouts. Thank you so much. Have a lovely rest of your Thursday.